Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended. With 16 locations, including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor. FlukeHearing.com.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I don't know how many more four-day weeks we can handle around here. I'll tell you, it has been, we've packed more into 4 days than a lot of weeks that we've worked 5 days. And I think the Mackinac Conference is to, how we attribute that here this week. Also coming up on the show later today, Friday, the last day of May, Current State was at a very emotional moment yesterday in Jackson, where the 1421st unit of the Michigan National Guard returned from 9 months in Afghanistan. Our microphones were there. Kevin Lavery was there. And we have an interesting report on that that I think you'll like later in the hour. Peter Wharf and Al Martin of Current Sports visited the Greater Lansing Sports Hall of Fame recently, too, and we're going to share in that coming up in the program today as well. Now, twice today on the program, Current State talks to key participants at the Mackinac Policy Conference. Governor Rick Snyder is scheduled to join us in about 20 minutes. As you may know, education and the Michigan economy is the theme of most of what's happening at this year's Mackinac Gathering. Yesterday, I had the chance to catch up with the president of the State Board of Education, John Austin, who's on Mackinac, and I first asked him his responses to yesterday's keynote speaker, Michelle Ree, the head of an organization called Students First and the ex-top administrator for the City of Washington, D.C. schools. Ree, as you may know, called for the adoption of National Common Core curricula here in Michigan. Here is how John Austin responded to that.
Michelle's message with Students First, and you know, famously the czar, I guess, of Washington D.C. schools. There's a lot of things that we agree on and that we're right. I mean, she started off saying teachers matter most. We should be better elevating, supporting teachers. She talked about the need to have high standards. Both she and Jeb Bush exhorted our Michigan leaders who are here to embrace the high Common Core standards, which we already have in Michigan, that are sort of world-class learning standards in every school district. So they definitely encouraged us to stay the course there, which was very welcome. And Michelle, we had lunch together with many folks from our elected officials in the media more privately, and the one thing I was pushing her on, and both she and Jeb Bush talked a lot about, was, you know, enhancing choice and charters as good outcome, good options for people that need a good choice to improve outcomes, which I support, and I think we all support, or at least many do in Michigan. We need more high-quality charters and choices. But what I pushed her on, and she agreed and basically said to other folks, we do not need to expand schools or create new schools that are low performers. So we should both close down existing bad performing schools, whether they're charter or traditional public schools, which I think we all can agree on, but we should not allow expansion of new schools, whether they're charters or online schools, if they don't deliver high quality education. We should encourage high performing schools to be created and expand, but this has been a problem with our sort of agenda of the last few months, which I think has run its course with the Oxford Foundation and the new school creation ideas and school finance ideas coming from the governor and the legislature. Let's create new specialty schools, unlimited online schools, unlimited new charters, even if they're run by bad performers. We've got to stop that, and then we have to turn around and say, let's increase choices where we need them, but through high-quality providers.
Michelle Ree is hardly a stranger to bold positions. I understand she said that ineffective teachers are the biggest defenders of the status quo. They drive effective teachers nuts. That's a quote. She is also a supporter of expanding the Common Core curriculum, which you support.
Correct.
When you balance what you like about her thinking with what you may not like about her, what's the final verdict?
I think there's more to like in terms of a focus on improving outcomes and helping all kids reach high standards. However, you know, there are two big issues that I have with her approach. One is, it's still a little us versus them. While she is applauding the efforts to get together to work with your teachers and help them improve their learning and get rid of bad teachers, but also reward and support good teachers, there's a little bit of us, the reformers, versus them, the status quo, the educators, the teachers' unions. Somehow we have to defeat them. And I think that probably is why she's no longer chancellor in Washington, D.C. We have to work with our teachers to improve education. It can be done. The fact that we are among the states that has had tough teacher tenure reform, you know, you have to demonstrate ability to teach now, and an evaluation system is almost completed that would measure that. That evaluation system that includes student achievement is being developed by Deb Ball, University of Michigan Dean, with our teachers' unions. And they welcome and like the fact that there could be a supportive, thoughtful, multidimensional evaluation, but they have to co-create it. So when we're talking about improving education, teachers are the most important ingredient, educators in the buildings. We have to work with them and support them and craft together how they can do better for kids.
In your view, John Austin, how much do Michigan's education challenges boil down simply to funding, inadequate funding?
It certainly is not funding in isolation, or even that's not the most significant issue. The truth is, though, we've made and are making, if we can stay the course, all the non-funding reforms. We have high standards for our learners, for our kids, we want to keep. We have high standards and expectations for our teachers, we want to keep those. We have a very demanding set of
why are you a proponent?
Accountability system. But so we've done all the reforms. In order to make the reforms work, we have to now invest more in the things that move the needle, including investing directly in K-12 education, because people are laying off teachers. We have no counselors. We have cutting of arts and music and other supports that are essential to learning. So we've made the reforms that don't cost money. We've even changed teacher benefit and healthcare systems. Those are all important. But we now need to reinvest in the things that actually can move the needle, which is having excellent teachers, not laying off teachers.
A couple of times you referred to Michigan's existing high standards. How much higher do they need to be? You are a proponent of expanding the Common Core curriculum to Michigan, correct?
We 8 years ago passed the Michigan Merit Curriculum Standards, which brought us to be one of the most rigorous. To leave high school, you have to master a set of competencies that put us first among the nation. We embraced 2 years ago the Common Core because we were already there. It was basically aligned with our high Michigan merit standards. The Common Core was and is an effort to encourage other states who didn't raise their standards to raise them and have a high target of learning for all their young people. So we just need to stay the course on that so that all young people get a platform to take a next step, whether it's college or careers, that is essential in this global economy. And that's what the Common Core is. So we just need to stay the course on it. We're already ahead of the nation on standards. What I'm also saying is we need to catch up with the nation in states like Massachusetts that have invested significantly in teachers and in the frontline delivery of education if we're going to be successful in helping all young people, particularly those in challenged communities that come from families that don't give them a great start. It takes excellent teaching. It takes resources in our frontline classrooms to do that. If we expect, and we can, all those kids to learn.
Are you getting any feeling up there legislatively over the possibility, over the chances of the Common Core standards expanding here in Michigan? Should the state prepare to chart its own path, or do you think this could happen?
No, the State Board of Education is elected by the people. We chose to adopt the Common Core standards, which were an extension of our high rigor standards already. So, you know, we are already a leader. The issue is now whether a wrong-headed move by some legislators claiming that this is some federal takeover of education would reverse that. And I think at some point soon, hopefully, we'll have a vote, and it'll basically say we're going to continue the course on the Common Core. We need Democrats and Republicans to work together on that. And I think it was instructive. You have a Governor Snyder, you have Jeb Bush, former governor, education leader, both saying to our legislators, stay the course on the Common Core. Our business leaders who are in force here are saying, keep the Common Core. We can't have any young person, any Michigan community get a second-class education. They need a world-class education. And if we abandon a common set of high standards, that's what will happen. Some kids are going to be sentenced to a really bad education somewhere in Michigan, and that's unacceptable.
How many more Michigan citizens need to be persuaded that more education funding would actually help students as opposed to just perpetuate legacy costs in districts?
I think on this, on education, they're already there. Meaning when Albion closes its high school, when we see districts that are, including my own, Ann Arbor, a relatively well-off community, making dramatic cuts in laying off teachers, in ending arts and music and other programs that are so wonderful and important, the public is already there that we need to recommit to finance and spend money on our schools. We've made all the cuts, we've made all the reforms that one can imagine. So the public's there. We need a legislature and political leaders, some of whom unfortunately don't believe you should raise money or spend money on anything, not even schools. We need them to get the message from their citizenry. And I think people care about their local neighborhood schools. They want them to work. They don't want to see them hemorrhaged and beat up and diminished. And so we're there on education. We're still not there on roads and other things we need to invest in. But we need to now make it so.
Next month, the legislature will get the final report from the group exploring a model for teacher accountability here in Michigan. What needs to be a part of that framework, in your opinion?
Well, I think that's the excellent news is there's an example where a group led by experts is putting together a evaluation system with the input and help of teachers and even teachers' unions that's going to be thoughtful, it's going to be supportive, it's going to be multidimensional. Yes, teachers will be evaluated on whether their kids are learning, but they're also going to be evaluated on the quality and nature of their instruction. It's going to be a tool for helping them do better, not to punish them. And that's why we also have to reject the other ideologically driven bills that are in the legislature, unfortunately, for merit pay for teachers and not having a different assessment system than the one that's being developed by this Governor's Commission on Educator Excellence. We need to put in place this thoughtful, informed by teachers evaluation system so that we can continue the effort to improve teaching and insist on high quality teaching and provide support for teachers, not punish them.
How close attention does the State Board of Education pay to other states, even other countries, when it comes to reform and models for reform?
Absolutely. We pay tremendous attention. In fact, when we upped our standards and brought our high school curriculum content expectations forward, it was based on the national best practice of what leading states were doing in terms of high standards. Anytime we make a change or seek a change, whether it's in finance or whether it's in reform of how you evaluate teachers, we're always facilitating running processes like the Governor's Council on Educator Excellence that is bringing the best proven performance-driven techniques into what we try to make policy and law here in Michigan.
Is there a state or a local model for educating young people that you could point to as an example of a district doing something right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are many in Michigan that are doing a lot right, but as a state, Massachusetts has the best performing, meaning the kids learn and they graduate at the highest numbers, meaning they learn the skills. Massachusetts does a lot of things that we also are doing, including a rigorous sort of exit requirement for the skills all young people must master when they leave high school and an assessment of those skills, which we have with the Michigan Merit and Common Core. But they, for example, when they expand school choice and charters, they have a State Board of Education and local public school districts as the ones who expand and create new charters and choices as additions to high-quality options in the state. They don't have an open-ended, unregulated, no quality control, anybody can charter anything, or new online school districts being created. So we need to mimic the best states when we're looking at how we expand choice and options for young people and have it be governed by quality control, tight regulation, because markets don't regulate themselves. You need to ensure the kids are learning in every new school that we have or create, and that's our bottom line.
you dropped any consideration of running for governor recently, saying Mark Schauer is the guy. Are you and Mark Schauer basically on the same page with regard to education policy, or do you have differences?
No, we're not only very much on the same page. I'm looking over across the room here at Mark. We're not only I'm happy about Mark's candidacy because he's a leader, he's a person of integrity, and I'm sharing all my thoughts and all our thoughts about how we improve education and how we improve our economy, and I'm hopeful and optimistic that Mark will help us advance them.
What would you say to Michigan voters who voted for Governor Rick Snyder, saying that it was really time for a change, that a lot of the Democratic approaches to problem solving, particularly in education, were not getting addressed under Jennifer Granholm? And I mean, how would you make the case for Mark Schauer with that background?
Well, I think the truth is, under Governor Granholm, we were making these types of changes and doing so on a bipartisan basis, improving education and setting high standards. The economy collapsed in Michigan, and so voters were understandably going to pick a change. I think on education, on some other issues, though, what they didn't bargain for was the governor, who I hoped and we hoped would be a sort of moderate, pro-education, pro-environment, pro-city governor. The team that he leads, the Republican Party, is so conservative and so reactionary that they're only for cutting funding for education, higher education. They're for creating a free market, unregulated, new school creation, online charters with no quality control. And unfortunately, the governor has been facilitating that and encouraging it, perhaps. And that's wrong. And so I think on education and other issues, we're going to see, and we need, we should do it on a bipartisan basis, a counter agenda of how do we proactively and affirmatively build up and figure out how to fund adequately our system of schools, including make changes in how we do that make sure all schools improve and that we have additional choices that are high quality.
John Austin is president of the Michigan State Board of Education. He's been speaking to us from the Mackinac Policy Conference. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And now, time for another Current State Public Poetry Announcement.
A Poem for S by Jessica Greenbaum. Because you used to leaf through the dictionary, casually, as someone might in a barber shop, and devotedly, as someone might in a sanctuary, each letter would still have your attention if not for the responsibilities life has tightly fit, like gears around the cog of you, like so many petals hinged on a daisy. That's why I'll just use your initial. Do you know that in one treasured story, a Jewish ancestor, horseback in the woods at Yom Kippur and stranded without a prayer book, looked into the darkness and realized he had merely to name the alphabet to ask for forgiveness? No congregation of figures needed. He could speak one letter at a time, because all of creation proceeded from those. He fed his horse, and then quietly, because it was from his heart, he recited them slowly, from Aleph to Tav. Within those sounds, all others were born, all manner of trials, actions, emotions, everything needed to understand who he was, had been, how flaws venerate the human being, how aspirations return without spite. Now, for you, may your wife's X-ray return with good news. May we raise our zarfs to both your names in the great book of life. A Poem for S by Jessica Greenbaum. I'm Stephanie Glazier, and this public poetry announcement is brought to you by the Center for Poetry at Michigan State University's Residential College in the Arts and Humanities.
Current State on WKAR, thanks for joining us. Today is the final day of the Detroit Regional Chamber's Mackinac Policy Conference. Michigan education and the economy have dominated the sessions this year. Here to share his thoughts on all the issues discussed at the annual gathering, we welcome to Current State, live from Mackinac Island, Governor Rick Snyder. How are you?
Good. Good morning.
Good
morning. Beautiful day up here.
Glad to have you aboard, Governor. There's a lot of news emanating from the island. Is there anything happening that, from your point of view, is being underreported?
One thing is we launched something really cool called DoSomethingMichigan.com yesterday. And it really came out of doing meetings with young people, particularly in southeastern Michigan and Detroit. And they kept on saying, we want to get involved. We want to help. And so what we did is we came up with a website and a texting system to really get them involved. And we're doing this in partnership with DHIVE in Detroit and the Michigan Community Service Commission across the rest of the state. And so if you literally text the word ACTION to 25827, or you can go to DoSomethingMichigan.com, you'll get a response back. And they're going to work with you on helping you volunteer, to mentor, to speak out, to get involved. And we just launched this yesterday afternoon, and I think we had literally over 4,000 or so people sign up already.
Fantastic. DoSomethingMichigan.com. Well, there's there's a flood of people going there as we speak. So the conference's two keynote speakers, Jeb Bush and Michelle Rhee, like you, are supporters of adopting the Common Core educational curriculum here in Michigan. Both made that clear in their addresses. Are you detecting any growing support or even any growing willingness to reconsider Common Core funding among legislative Republicans who oppose it?
Well, I think we are making progress there in terms of the budget process. They put some language in the budget that gives us some time to work on that. So it's really something that we can continue to say, let's get some positive response on Common Core before October 1, and then we can move ahead. And I think a lot of it is getting a good dialogue about what Common Core is all about, because it's really about, it was done by the National Governors Association with school officers working together at the state level to say, don't we need to be more competitive on a global basis, and let's do some standards for math and reading in particular, and raise those standards so we can be competitive. It wasn't a federal mandate at all or a federal program. And so that's something that I think we just need to get the message out to say, don't we want to be globally competitive, to do it well, do it right, and let's talk about it.
So the Common Core discussion, if I'm hearing you correctly, the Common Core discussion will be continuing well beyond June 1st, probably closer to October 1st?
Yeah, it should be continuing. I mean, there's a couple other things. We got the budget's largely done. It'll be wrapped up early next week. In many respects, and it's a very strong budget, but there are two or three items. I also want to follow up on Healthy Michigan about the question of better coverage for individuals, particularly with more wellness orientation and a primary medical home model. And the other one is transportation funding. We still need to keep working that issue. We put some significant resources towards it, but there's more to be done. One big accomplishment in this budget that is part of the part that is getting passed is early childhood education. I'm very excited by that.
What do you make, I have to ask you this, what do you make of this profound skepticism of all things federal from the conservative wing of your party? How do you interpret that, and where do you think this comes from?
Well, it's not hard to figure out where it comes from. Is Washington's a mess. And I think that's an accurate statement in the sense that if you look at it, they don't even do a budget anymore. They haven't for several years. The debt. National debt continues to grow, and there's a need for tax reform. So there's a paralysis in Washington. That's a real problem. I believe that is holding back our whole national economy, and I think that causes some skepticism. What I would say is let's be proactive in Michigan about solving our issues, trying to be a good partner and working forward and doing it in a Michigan way, because in just those three big issues I mentioned, we've solved them in Michigan in the last two or three years. So they are solvable, and let's be a good role model, and Michigan can be a role model for Washington being successful.
There is reportedly new data from the Highway Loss Data Institute showing total insurance claims resulting from motorcycle accidents in Michigan rose 51% after the state ended its mandatory helmet law in April of last year. Any second thoughts about repealing the mandatory helmet law in Michigan?
Well, what I'd say is that you talked about accidents, and that the question is what kind of accidents and the consequences, because that's where the helmet becomes most particularly acute. It's something that's worth continuing to watch. What I would say is we have 1 year's data. And I've looked at historical data. That can vary dramatically from year to year. And it's really important we look at a longer-term trend line. So let's just keep monitoring that. But if it is a real issue, then we should potentially revisit. But I would say that would be another year or two out.
We're talking with Michigan Governor Rick Snyder live from Mackinac Island. Are you enjoying any level of success persuading those fellow Republicans who oppose Medicaid expansion to reconsider their positions?
Well, I think we're making positive progress. They've come forward with what they would like to see in a Healthy Michigan plan. I think there's a number of good ideas that they put forward that deal with wellness, again, more primary home medical model, how people can be involved in their own health care, saying people should get a physical. Those are all good things. There are a couple aspects that I think are much more challenging. There's a 48-month requirement, a couple other things that I think aren't feasible, and those are the kind of discussions we're having. So I hope over the next couple weeks we can work through what are some of the great things they put on the table that we can do? What are some of the things that may not be viable that we hopefully could look at dropping, and then let's get something done? Because I think it's a great opportunity to improve our system. Right now we have an uncontrolled, unmanaged system where people use the emergency room far too often, and we could get to a medical home model, a primary care model that could bring down cost to society and save us all money.
Is this the kind of topic that is being discussed person to person, Democrat to Republican, Republican to Democrat at the Mackinac Conference?
Oh, yeah, and I'm doing it not in a partisan fashion. I'm just trying to talk to legislators in general about some of these kind of issues because, again, you shouldn't make partisanship the key driver. The driver that we should be working on is what's best for the citizens of Michigan, our customers.
I was under the impression, and I think a lot of our listeners were under the impression, that the measure in the state Senate involving the Education Achievement Authority would expand the number of schools overseen by the EAA, but yesterday you said that's really not what the bill is about, and that the EAA already has the authority to do just that. Can you clarify what this is about, please?
Well, no, that was a correct statement you just said, that the EAA can have schools added to it anytime. It's really up to the state superintendent, and that's under existing law. So the statute that was being talked about that people quite often try to say they don't want to do it because it would allow the EAA to grow is simply inaccurate. In fact, one of the things I was happy to do is let's put some constraints or let's put some parameters on it in the legislation that actually would make it more managed. So that's where there's a lot of misinformation out there. The EAA is doing tremendous things. I mean, one of the exciting things we did yesterday was announce a $100 million fundraising campaign with private dollars and nonprofit dollars to help the EAA, to help Excellent Schools Detroit, and to do a scholarship program for Detroit kids. And if you look at the people that have given to that in terms of the nonprofit community, the corporate community, and individual community, there's so many wonderful people that have done a lot of good due diligence on the EAA and think it's a very good thing.
But there's nothing stopping the EAA from actually adding another three dozen schools under its purview now?
Well, again, the EAA doesn't make that decision. It would be done by the state superintendent. But it could be done. But the point is I don't think that would be appropriate, and I don't think Mike Flanagan does either. Because, again, the EAA is just getting started, and it should be some more managed growth path. And so I wouldn't expect schools to be added, even though it's permissible by law today, you know, for this next year.
The Detroit News recently reported on inflated claims the EAA made to win a federal grant for a merit pay program. Was that an issue, and has it been settled?
Well, I think that's been resolved. Again, when you look at many things going on, it's like in many things, and I think it was a case where they were talking about potential future growth. That wasn't implying that it was going to be necessarily what happened, but it was an up-to kind of analysis to say the numbers could go up to this. That didn't mean it was necessarily in law or in statute to say it was going to add that many schools. So I think, again, a lot of this is people stepping back to say, let's just not be against something. Let's look at the facts.
All right. We are pleased to have had to have joined you here this morning. Governor Rick Snyder, live from Mackinac Island. Governor, thank you. We'll talk again soon.
That's great to be with you. Take care.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. The last day of the month is here already, and as we've done the end of every month on Current State, we review the top stories of the month, and we join Angela Whitrock, late of M Live. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Mark.
And Elaine Kolhanek of LSJ Media also joins us this morning to talk about everything that we stirred up in May. How are you, Elaine?
Good morning. Good.
I would like to start with just with your take on the most memorable or most impactful story from the month we're wrapping up. Angela?
I would go with the city budget. I mean, once again, the city faced a pretty large deficit. And once again, it was balanced without a ton of pain or obvious pain for city residents, unless you count the 130 fees that will be increased or added. So, you know, pocketbooks galore again.
That is a ton of fees.
That is
130.
Yes, either new or increased fees. So everything from buying a burial plot in the city to parking tickets is going up.
Wow. Elaine Kolhanek, what about you? I know you followed the city budget too, but...
Well, I actually, that would have been on my list as well, and not just for what the city did, but for what it didn't do, because I think that the work of the financial health team in making long-term recommendations was vital, and I've met some of the people who were on that committee. They've been to our editorial board meetings, and it's really a stellar collection of business leaders in this community, and to have devoted all their time to that. Now, I know we've also talked to the mayor about, you know, why he made the choices he made and that those are not things that can be done quickly. And I, you know, I do hope that that work gets the attention that it deserves.
Did this lead to some tension between Dave Hollister and Mayor Bernero? I mean,
that's
a lot of
the impression I've had. Yes,
that's the impression I've had as well.
Yeah.
But I guess things maybe have been smoothed over.
I would. You know, they both can be quite diplomatic when they need to be. So, but I think there was some initial friction, and everyone has seen the fuss that's been made about the possibility of selling off the DIA assets in order to resolve Detroit's problems.
Sure.
You know, when Lansing's sort of maybe equivalent of that would be the Board of Water and Light, and when that financial health team just mentioned that things such as assets like the BWL might be, you know, included in their discussions, there was an immediate no from above. And I don't have a position on whether we should get rid of, you know, sell the BWL or not. I don't know if that's an answer to anything, but the point is, I think we need to look bigger than what we're looking. I mean, we can nickel and dime people with 130 fee increases and, you know, try to hide $5 million in their increased BWL rates, but they're still going to be paying one way or the other. And unless something more dramatic gets done about the city's structural deficit, that's just going to continue indefinitely.
Barring the highly unforeseen, we know Michigan's next Democratic candidate for governor will be Mark Schauer. The Governor Snyder's picked up a bunch of detractors recently, but admittedly, early polls suggest it may not be a walk for the Democrat by any means. What do you make of a Schauer candidacy, and what do you make of his chances, assuming Governor Snyder runs again, Angela?
Well, I think it'll be fascinating to see how the Dems pull together around this. It's, you know, in an election like this where it's so polarized, it's got to be mobilizing the base against mobilizing the base. And that was certainly a problem in the last go-around, getting Dems out to the polls a lot of Dems voted for Snyder last time around. So, you know, really, it's going to be a challenge, I think, at least initially, looking at the message for Schauer to really, you know, go on the attack. He's such a nice guy.
Yeah.
He's so compassionate and so, you know, he does all the nice things. And I think he's going to have to find a way to give a little edge to his message to, you know, show that he's tough in a different way. He's, you know, trying to set himself up as like the working class fighter. You know, he's the guy who got maced in the face at right to work protests. But there's got to be a way, I think, for him to really make his case to Dems and to anybody on the fence, or maybe anybody who voted for Snyder who feels a little betrayed or, you know, undersold, that he's, you know, he's different. He's more like like working class Michiganders. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be the challenge, is finding a way to really hammer that message home and get people excited about voting for him, not necessarily just against Snyder.
We have two really intelligent, really serious candidates for governor this
time around.
It's
a very cerebral election, yes.
Without a doubt. Elaine, anything to add?
Well, I think, you know, Schauer's biggest strength may be that the Democrats have coalesced around him 18 months before the actual election.
Sure.
They have made a group decision that they will spend not one thin dime on a primary for governor.
Again, not like last time.
They are going to really, you know, put some effort into this. And I, you know, I suspect how much money everybody has to spend is going to be a very significant factor, because, you know, Governor Snyder will have plenty. I also think that, you know, Mr. Schauer, he is a very intellectual, very bright politician, and I think, you know, probably has, you know, very good character for the challenge ahead. But he has a disadvantage in name recognition. He's not holding an office currently. He lost his last election. There are some people, because he was, you know, minority leader of the Senate, but it's been a while, don't really realize the extent of his state political experience. And
that begs the question, how important was it to resolve this early, just as a factor of getting his name out there and without cluttering it up with some other candidate in the next 18 months? Huge, I think.
And they also did it in such a coordinated way. I mean, the beginning of the month, the Democratic Governors Association polling says Snyder's essentially tied with Schauer in their polling results. And then the next day, I think John Austin said, I'm not going to run. And then the day after that, Virge Bonero said, I'm not going to run. And everybody says, I'm not running and I'm supporting Schauer. And it went on for like a week with people. And, you know, then they closed the month with Schauer officially making his announcement. So they obviously, you know, that was a group effort. They've made their decision and they're trying to make it successful.
It seems like maybe, too, you see a little bit of the Dems learning from the mistakes of the last election cycle, where, you know, it turned out that John Cherry raised more money than anybody, but he didn't even officially get into the race. You know, so the guy who maybe stood the best chance of winning what was pretty much an unwinnable election for the Dems was out before it even started. And I think, like Elaine said, it's really important that the Dems got behind one guy this early out.
Mm-hmm. Four Democratic state senators, one of them East Lansing's Gretchen Whitmer, have introduced bills advancing recognition of same-sex marriages. I'll quickly run through what these four measures would do. One would allow voters to repeal the constitutional amendment banning recognition of same-gender relationships by the government. One would call on the federal government to repeal DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. Senator Whitmer's would repeal limitations on same-sex relationships prior to 2004, when the state constitutional amendment was enacted. And the fourth would recognize such marriages that have happened in states where they're already legally recognized, and would recognize them here in Michigan. I've got to get your response to this. Angela?
Well, they're going nowhere. I mean, they're obviously important social issues, I think, for a majority of people in the state, but, you know, just looking at the tenor of the composition of the state Senate and the state House, I mean, these bills will probably be lucky to even get a hearing or get assigned to a committee where they'll have a chance at getting a hearing. And I think what you're seeing more of, actually, is local elected officials, you know, this week and the week over the last month, really, stepping it up and trying to find ways to circumvent the state legislature, because they know that, you know, as interesting and compelling as important as legislation like this is for a lot of people, it's just not going to get a hearing. It's not going to get a vote. And even if it does get a vote, it's not going to pass. So instead, you see, you know, folks like Curtis Hertel, the Register of Deeds, finding ways to recognize same-sex relationships through property rights and property filings.
Right.
And you see the ordinances that are going to be brought up in Meridian Township and other surrounding areas to essentially protect the rights of LGBT residents in ways that currently aren't allowed. I think that's what we'll see more of happening, absent any even motivation or any desire from the state legislature to look at this issue again.
Elaine, care to? Yeah,
to change that constitutional amendment, I think what happens is that both houses would have to have a two-thirds majority, and then it would go on to a ballot, and people would have to vote.
Yes, that would lead to a popular vote.
Yeah. So, I think I tend to agree that the legislature, the Democrats, don't have enough pull in the legislature perhaps yet to make that happen. But I think there's there may be a possibility of an initiated ballot proposal that bypasses the legislature, I think, over time. I don't know, that definitely won't happen in 2014, but it may be 2016 or maybe somewhere after that. I think that you're seeing across the country a turning of opinion on this issue
Without a doubt, rapidly
than anybody would have expected. And even earlier this week, I read an editorial that was in the Dallas Morning News, where they were calling upon the shareholders of ExxonMobil to support a policy in favor of equal rights for gay employees and, you know, equal benefits for gay employees. And I mean, when can you imagine something like that, seeing a newspaper editorial calling on a company? And obviously the reason, it's an economic issue in the state of Texas. A lot of people work for ExxonMobil, and a lot of people who want those benefits can't get them at ExxonMobil.
One of the reasons I had to pursue this, I mean, it did just happen, and it happened in the month of May, was to try to contrast the incredible momentum that these issues have right now.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I've seen attitudes toward an issue change so dramatically, so quickly in my life. It's really astounding. But contrasting that momentum with the legislative mm-hmm. realities, I had to find out how much could the local initiatives get done, do you think?
Well, what they would do is essentially expand the rights that are available to everyone, to you and I, essentially, to anyone who identifies as LGBT. Right now, in, you know, outside of East Lansing, basically, and Lansing, if you're gay, you can be fired, and there's no protection.
And once again, it's Meridian Township that's looking at
this. It's Meridian, Delhi, and Delta, I think.
Okay. Okay.
And yeah, what they would do is they would offer the protections that, you know, statewide, it would be something you would have to amend the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act to do. What they're doing is mocking up ordinances that are very similar to East Lansing's, which was passed in the 70s, expanding that locally instead.
Elaine Kulhanek, give us your most overlooked story of May. What do you think?
Well, I actually wonder about the Consumers Mutual Insurance, which is the co-op that's being created. It's going to be based in East Lansing.
Dennis Litos, yeah,
and
he
that
was on
is
the show.
I started with a grant under the Affordable Care Act,
yes.
And I believe that a bunch of Michigan counties are involved in it that had been running their health programs for low-income people that will be sort of dissolved once the Affordable Care Act fully kicks in next year. And I just think that that's a very new trend, consumer-owned insurance, such as it were, and I'm not sure that we really have explored everything that that means yet.
Angela, what about you?
I'm going to go with a kind of off-the-beaten-path story. You know, there are the string of sexual assaults in East Lansing, three that we know about, and, you know, there are a lot of unresolved questions. We know that someone's out there, you know, attacking women, and it's happening in a pretty contained area of the city. But there's a lot, I think, of a lot of reporting to be done on whether there are any other prior incidents of this happening, whether it's, you know, what do you do? It's kind of a big deal for there to be a serial sex assaulter on the loose in a city. And time and again, when things like this happen, we don't really, I think, get the coverage it merits.
There was a pretty detailed drawing of the suspect, I guess, that they're
Correct,
looking for
yeah.
in the paper the other day. May was quite a month for the insurance industry in Lansing, in East Lansing as well. Elaine referred to the to the Consumers Mutual situation, but Jackson National Life was a big part of this as well. It announced it wants to expand in Aladdin Township and hire another 1,000 people. Can we add Jackson National to this discussion as well, Elaine? What do you take away from that company's success?
Well, I think that's a huge indicator of the kind of turnaround in the local economy, that they could certainly expand any place that they want to. When you're talking about putting 1,000 jobs, you could go anywhere with that and probably get incentives from, you know, communities anywhere in the country. And they decided to do it here, and I think that that's a really positive sign for the community. And they are such a community-focused company as well. I mean, they encourage their employees to be out and involved in things and donating their time and volunteering. And you know, I mean, they're really a good corporate citizen for this community, and I think it's very positive that they did that.
Angela, anything to add?
I think what's also important, you know, is this is a different kind of expansion from what we see in a different type of economic announcement. Usually we, you know, there's a big splash, there's a promise of jobs, et cetera, and whether it happens is sort of a toss-up. With Jackson National Life, you know, they've got a track record of growth. They grow quietly. They don't make a big deal out of it. So they've been adding, you know, 150, 200 jobs a year for the past few years. I think there's little doubt that their expansion is necessary. They're basically bursting at the seams in their present location. And they, you know, as Elaine said, they're a fairly well-known corporate citizen. They do a lot in the community. And, you know, it's fabulous, the prospect of 1,000 jobs in the next few years.
Do either of you give any thought to the generosity, let's say, involved in the tax incentives that become part of these deals? Either with GM, I mean, we have a hard time resisting the opportunity to hire more people.
Right.
Are the incentives in sync with the payoffs to the community there? It's hard to resist 1,000 new jobs.
Well, it's a little bit different in the case of Jackson. I mean, this is it's not technically in the city of Lansing, so one of the incentives allows the 425 allows Lansing to recoup some of that tax revenue that's generated in exchange for offering other incentives that help offset costs. That's a lot different than, you know, say like the incentives that the city approved for the casino. You know, you can make a case that, you know, what they're doing for Jackson allows more economic flexibility, whereas what happens with projects like the casino, you know, a lot of people criticize as padding the profit line for the developers. I think Jackson's a completely different example of how economic incentives are being used.
Elaine, anything to add to that?
I think that when you're doing things that help major employers that have a long-term commitment in the community to expand in the community, that is very much a different kind of investment than when you're kind of gambling, if you will, mm-hmm. whether it's a casino or somebody else on, you know, on a new business coming in and offering them a lot of tax breaks and other support to get them here without really any proven track record or any idea of how many of the, you know, how successful they'll really be, how many jobs they'll really give you. So I would tend to agree that, you know, when GM needs a tax break, we should probably take a pretty hard look at that. And if, you know, a company like Jackson National or one of the other major employers in town wants to talk about that, I think it's worth talking about.
Okay. We want to thank both of you for joining us on our Month in Review segment. It was really good. Elaine Kohanic of LSJ Media, Angela Whitrock, late of M Live and soon of Ingham County. We will miss you, and we wish you the best of luck. I have a jar of Miggy's salsa in my office for you.
Kidding?
She's the world's biggest Miguel Cabrera fan, so that is awaiting you.
Thanks to
both of you.
Thanks.
That sounds like music for the BWL chili cook-off later today. I think that's ideal. That's what we were trying to conjure up there. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we recap the Great Lakes Governor's Leadership Summit. Yes, there is a weekend edition of Current State. Also, John Gallagher on the long-term considerations. This is next week. John Gallagher joins us from the Free Press on the long-term considerations needed to rebuild a city. That and more next week on Current State. We want to take a minute today to thank some of our staff for their hard work. Thank you, Bill Richards, Kathy Zell, Carol Carber, Katie Wolf, Jeannie Krupp, Harold Beer, Tom Kinney, and our general manager, Gary Reed. We've got Weekend Current State coming up this weekend with Emmanuel Berry as well, and we want to thank everybody for joining us here this week. Dozens of anxious military families filled Lumen Christi Catholic High School in Jackson yesterday to welcome home their soldiers from Afghanistan. The 1461st Transportation Company is back home after a 9-month tour of duty. Current state's Kevin Lavery and Becky McHenry witnessed the joyful reunion in Jackson. We're going to leave you with the sounds of those emotional moments. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Please welcome the troops of the 1461st Combat Headquarters. Dear God, today we rejoice because of the safe return of the 1461st Transportation Company. We thank you for each soldier here today, their personal sacrifice, and the dedication to our great nation. May God continue to bless America, and all God's people said, amen. Ladies and gentlemen, the 1461st Transportation Company Commander, Captain Taylor.
We conducted a total of 102 missions. Traveled approximately 126,902 miles, and I want all of you to know that that success, what I just bragged about, would not have been possible without the strength of our families and everyone back home being strong and helping us to stay focused.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes our ceremony today.
Coming home?
My husband. Just overjoyed completely. I'm so happy today. So it's just amazing having him home.
Dustin McCarn. Oh, I got basically my whole family, my mom, stepdad, my dad, stepmom, brothers and sisters, cousin, friends. And that's.
Could you see them right away when you walked in?
Oh yeah, they were sitting right in front row, so seeing them easy.
That's got to be difficult to march in formation and see your family, but not able to say hi to them.
Yes, sir. It is.
Yeah. Yep. We feel very proud and thankful on Dustin's return and the whole 1461st troop. My name is Lori Pridgen. I'm his mother.
It's my son, his best friend, his wife. They were hit by an IED. Two of the Purple Heart recipients. He was the worst injured. He was injured also. There was a third one that they were looking for. They were all three friends.
Good to be with my brothers. I'm glad to see them. They're all here and all in one piece.
Support for WKAR is provided by Douglas J. with two Lansing area salon locations, the Okemah Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for graduation and Father's Day, DouglasJ.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.